when you look at Silicon Valley, as much as it's an incredible ecosystem, people realize now that they can come down to Southern California, have a better quality of life, and still build great companies.
I'm Scott McGrew. Welcome to Sand Hill Road.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Adam Strzok is an up-and-coming venture capitalist. The name may not be familiar, but he's made solid investments in Nutanix, Postmates, and a fascinating new company we'll get to in a moment called Mythical. So the Strzok name may not be familiar to you yet, but it's well known in South Africa. Adam's grandfather found his fortune there after fleeing the Holocaust. Here's Adam.
I remember at a very young age, you know, just asking my parents, how did we arrive here? And it actually goes back to my grandparents. My grandparents were all Jews in Eastern Europe, you know, mainly like Lithuania. So it's that real story of sort of you're eating dinner one day, the next thing you know, Nazi troops are in your house. They rip you away from your family. You're put on a train. You know, you never see your father and your brother. You know, again, your younger sister immediately gets killed because she's too young. On my dad's side, my grandfather, he actually had like 12 brothers and sisters. They were all killed literally like marched into the forest and shot. He was able to escape, got on a boat to South Africa. He then was literally apparently like selling snacks on the mine for like 2 years. And he saved up enough money to buy a piece of land. And that land ended up having mineral rights. And he then used that to start a very flourishing business called National Manganese Mines. So yeah, really interesting story. You know, incredible adversity, but a lot of triumph at the end.
It is interesting that a family that is fleeing intolerance ends up in South Africa.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, from his perspective, there weren't really many other options. It was not easy for Jews to get into America. And I think he just saw South Africa as a land with rich mineral resources and a place of opportunity. You know, I think, you know, there wasn't much of a choice, so he just went with what he went with. But, you know, I think Jews, you know, really do understand, you know, just sort of, you know, the horrific atrocities that African Americans have gone through, because, you know, in the Old Testament, Jews themselves were slaves. And, you know, I know that my family never agreed with apartheid. But at the end of the day, I think a lot of European countries have had very bad histories there. You know, he could have not gone to South Africa, gone to America, but America clearly has its own issues, you know, as it relates to racial tension.
This idea of being an immigrant with very little money, in the case of your grandfather, just enough to sell snacks and turn that into a fortune. He does that in South Africa, but that is also a very American story. One of the investments you have is in Nutanix. I've talked to the CEO, Dheeraj Pandey, several times. He came to America with $800. He creates Nutanix.
Well, I came here with $800 and I started the company in 2009. So the company's barely 8 years old.
I love that story, both because it makes me proud to be an American, but also there's a certain sense of wonderment on my side, because as an American native, I often think the story we tell immigrants of come to the new world, you know, with a few dollars in your pocket and find your fortune is just a story. And then people do it. and turn $800 into billions.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. And Nutanix was an incredible investment that I was very lucky enough to be a part of. And he obviously achieved tremendous success with that. I remember, being an insider at Nutanix, and literally days before the IPO, the company got an all-cash acquisition offer from Cisco for $5 billion. I really wanted them to take that because I wouldn't have had to wait 180 days for the lockup period to expire as an insider. But, you know, Dheeraj sort of just being true to his original form, right? He chose not to take it because he wanted to take the company public and he wanted to be in charge of the narrative going forward. And I think that that ability to sort of understand that, you know, I'm okay with nothing and I feel great, you know, having a lot, but it doesn't change who I am. And it really allows you to channel that entrepreneurial spirit and take big risks.
There is a trust that you put in Dheeraj because, you know, that idea that, hey, by the way, I turned down $5 billion and we're just going to, you know, we're going to take it public and see where it goes. I am, you know, I'm just not that. I'm very conservative. I do the 30-year fixed mortgage, even though the banker says, are you insane? I mean, look at this, you know, look at this variable rate. This would be much better. I'm like, no, I'm going to go with what I know. So, yeah, you get that phone call where it's like we turned down a $5 billion acquisition offer. And I would imagine anyone would go, wait, how much?
Yeah. Yeah, you're 100% right. And I actually remember, I think, you know, right after Nutanix IPO'd, the price really shot up and it was greater than a $5 billion market cap. And I said, wow, you know, I think Dheeraj really knows what he's doing. But post lockup, it was actually below $5 billion. But, you know, either way, I think as a venture capitalist, you have to defer to the cadence of the founders. And, you know, Nutanix is just such an incredible success story. I understand why maybe he didn't want to join sort of one of the largest legacy incumbents like Cisco. You know, maybe you lose your identity as a company. But generally, yeah, you know, it's we're minority investors. We definitely have to defer to the founders.
And he clearly made the right decision.
Definitely.
So the reason you're able to invest in part is because you were able to create your own fortune. And, you know, you come from a family in which the family name is known in South Africa. You grow up comfortably. This is a recipe sometimes for disaster. To be the grandchild of a, you know, someone who owns a manganese mine.
Yep, manganese, yep.
Right, thank you, that kind of mine. There's a recipe there or a potential for disaster. And yet you are able to, you grew up, you know, with some roads paved for you, but you are able to create your own way. And tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, I think, definitely, you know, grew up, you know, quote unquote privileged, but I think I realized from at a very young age that, you know, whatever wealth, you know, my family had, call it maybe in the 70s or whatever, you know, at the time the rand was equal to the dollar. Now, due to inflation in South Africa, it's around 14 rand to the dollar. And then you divide that up, you know, between my father and his brothers and sisters, you realize that, you know, maybe you have a good name and maybe you're comfortable, but it's nowhere near the sort of American wealth that I've grown up to actually see, especially being in venture capital. So I think I knew from a very young age that, you know, I've got great entrepreneurial fiber and, you know, grandfathers that have accomplished a lot, grandmothers that have accomplished a lot. But I knew that if I really wanted to sort of give my children what maybe my father grew up with, you know, I would really have to work. And I've never had a problem with that. I've always said sort of adversity is the stone upon which I sharpen my sword, and I'm happy to take risks. So, you know, after Northwestern University, I went straight to Georgetown Law. I then actually was an M&A private equity attorney at Kirkland & Ellis in the New York Corporate Practice Group. But I really quickly realized that I was sort of on the wrong side of the proverbial fence. I really wanted to be an entrepreneur, a founder, you know, the one scoring the goals, not just making sure that the scoreboard is written up correctly. So my brother, who's actually 7 years older than me and very entrepreneurial, was starting a company called Long Island Brand Beverages. And I chose to leave Kirkland & Ellis and join him as a co-founder and board member. I remember my mother crying because I was her good, you know, lawyer son and leaving to go take big risks. But, you know, it really was for the best. And, you know, with respect to Long Island Brand Beverages, we, you know, it was a difficult road. We wanted to initially go out. We were really inspired by Bethany Frankel and the Skinny Girl Margarita concept, a sort of very premium, ready to drink, sort of alcoholic product. She ended up selling that to Jim Beam. It was a great success story. We wanted to do the same thing with Long Island Iced Tea because we didn't think that there was anyone really owning that brand. But, you know, what we realized really quickly was the slotting fees, you know, were sort of killing our margins. And we actually had an opportunity to get into a bunch of vending machines. But the caveat, in order to actually be in the vending machines and give us scale that would allow us to, you know, increase our margins and deal with these difficult slotting fees, the caveat was that we couldn't be alcoholic because you can't put alcoholic drinks in vending machines.
Which is like what a Long Island Iced Tea is, like pure, it's practically like, pure alcohol.
Exactly.
With a dollop of Coke in it.
Exactly. Yeah. So we actually ended up realizing that there was such an incredible grassroots affinity just for the name and the brand Long Island Iced Tea. And when we did a bunch of sort of, testing on the iced tea market generally, we realized that at the time, Arizona Iced Tea, was sort of they controlled the market. And then Arizona Iced Tea was like 60 grams of high fructose corn syrup. So we felt that, you know, if we could come to market with an organic iced tea that used cane sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup, used things like reverse osmosis filtration to preserve the integrity of the tea leaf, and could really sort of benefit from, maybe the lower customer acquisition costs that would come along the Eastern Corridor because people had such an affinity to the grassroots association with Long Island Iced Tea, we thought we could actually be successful. So we took a really big risk, and we actually ended up scaling that company to 7,800 mom and pops. We bootstrapped it to over $40 million in top line. We ended up selling it to a middle market private equity firm called Cullen Investments. And they actually combined the company with a few other assets and for a short period of time took it public on the NASDAQ. So it was a really incredible story. My brother then went right into another company called Hungry Root, which has raised, maybe $50 million to date, including a big round of capital from Lightspeed Venture Partners. He has Jeremy Liu, one of the most prolific VCs in the world, on his board. I went a different direction, and I was kind of tired of low-margin, commoditized CPG products. My brother still loves that. I'm much more of a software guy, and I just thought that venture capital would be a really incredible way for me to combine my legal and operational expertise and really help young founders, sort of give them that first round of institutional capital and then get them to a point that they can quote unquote graduate to the Andreessens, the Lightspeeds, the Sequoias of the world. And that's what we're doing day in, day out. And, couldn't be happier.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Now, you say you're a software investor, but you're not in Silicon Valley. You chose to base in LA. Why is that?
Yeah, you know, I think Silicon Valley right now is a little bit overrated, you know, especially now in the sort of post-COVID world. And, you know, there's such incredible remote software out there. You can really start a business from anywhere. I think when I went, we were in Manhattan, New York. My wife and I had done 10 freezing winters between Northwestern and Georgetown Law and then New York. And, you know, we had some family here in LA and we said, you know, why don't we just, again, take a risk? You know, we got an Airbnb in the Hollywood Hills and we ended up just absolutely falling in love with Los Angeles. And I think what I realized in a very short period of time is there's just such an incredible ecosystem here. Yes, you know, Google and Facebook were not built here, but, you know, Snapchat is incredible. Honest Company is incredible. You know, you've got Service Titan, Cornerstone. There's so many sort of large software companies that have put themselves in a situation that, you know, sort of employees zero to, you know, maybe one to two to 100, you know, their shares fully vest, they get acquisitions, they go through IPOs, et cetera. And these people want to continue building in Los Angeles. And I think when you look at Silicon Valley, as much as it's an incredible ecosystem, you know, the culture is very monolithic. It's extremely expensive. And I think people realize now that they can come down to Southern California, have a bit more, you know, better quality of life and still build great companies. And, you know, I've really had the privilege of seeing, you know, a lot of the venture funds that have come up in Southern California. You now have these really large growth stage venture funds like Anthos and March Capital and 3L, you know, and these are funds that have raised hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And their sole purpose is to really sort of back that VC ecosystem in LA as they hit that growth stage of their life cycle. So, you know, for me as a seed stage investor, knowing that, you know, we have access to, you know, incredible companies, incredible talent, the UC sort of engineering system is top of the charts. And knowing that the capital is here in LA, you know, there's no reason not to build here. And I think if you're investing today as to where you think the world's going to be in 10 years, we truly believe that LA will be able to be pound for pound, you know, go pound for pound with Silicon Valley. And, you know, we want to be a huge part of the seed infrastructure as it relates to Los Angeles.
You originally made that 10-year prediction a couple of years ago in a magazine article. I think coronavirus, as you had touched on, really accelerates that, because all of a sudden, not only are we realizing we can work remotely, but we're realizing that through Zoom and whatnot, some of this stuff does not necessarily need to be person to person, at least not now. Maybe it'll come back and everyone will insist on that. But it does seem to have changed the entire ecosystem.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, we recently hosted a webinar a few weeks ago called Remote Fundraising, Perspectives from All Sides of the Deal Table. And we were lucky enough to have Amit Mukherjee, a partner at NEA, you know, one of the largest VC firms in the world, join us on that webinar. And, you know, what we all were sort of speaking about generally is it's actually a very exciting time right now to sort of back first principle thinkers at opportunistic terms who really sort of understand how that the world is changing and they can adapt to it faster. And that creates a sort of level of arbitrage. You know, what I will say generally is we spend a lot of time at Struck Capital, you know, trying to sort of predict where we think the world's going to go. And we want that to really impact our investment thesis. But what we don't want to do is sort of over index to some of these macro trends. You know, we're finding that some VCs they think they'll never be commercial real estate again. You know, if it's
and telemedicine, telemedicine.
Yeah,
telemedicine.
Exactly. And yes. they want to give crazy valuations to companies with no traction. We don't want to do that. I think sort of the conclusion that we have garnered is if there was already a sort of macro change that had velocity, it's very possible and plausible that sort of COVID is something that has dramatically increased that velocity. So when you look at things like the gradual shift of commerce moving from brick and mortar to online, you know, that's now something that that trend was already there, but now we think the velocity of that has dramatically increased, you know, and that's why, for example, we made a recent investment in a company called Blackcart that sort of removes all risk associated with you know, with essentially buying, you know, sort of they're starting off in fashion, but it removes all risk with sort of getting those clothes to your house to try and fit and then sending them back. It's basically a try before you buy option without forcing you to pay anything. So, you know, those types of investments are very interesting because they they're sort of countercyclical, and they're receiving increased momentum as a byproduct of COVID. But we do get leery, you know, when we hear VCs sort of saying they'll never be office space again. You know, if it's built on a Zoom API, it deserves a $30 million pre-money valuation. You know, we still want to just back incredible founders, and we want businesses that theoretically would work, you know, in a post-COVID world or a pre-COVID world.
One of the investments you've made that I don't quite understand is Mythical Games. And, you know, I'm a gamer. I grew up with Atari. I have an Xbox in my house. So I understand games, but I don't understand what you're doing with Mythical Games.
Yeah, Mythical Games is really an incredible investment. So we led the seed round of that. They've raised $38 million to date since then. They're based in Los Angeles. And the two founders, John and Jamie, were both former Activision studio heads and were responsible for games like Guitar Hero, you know, and Call of Duty. You know, if you've ever heard of a game called Fortnite, you know, Fortnite is sort of at the top of the list of these sort of free-to-play games where people are actually playing the games for free, but the games are generating billions and billions of dollars in revenue because the gamers are spending money on what are called skins. Think of a skin as very similar to if you want to drive like a nice car in real life or you want to wear that new designer label. Skins are sort of ways to show status of your avatar in game. So it could be a really cool weapon. It could be a cool print on your costume. You know, skins can even be supported by actual brands. It could be, for example, the new Nike Air Jordans. I want my, you know, my avatar in my favorite game to walk around with those shoes.
And kids will pay money for this. Kids and adults will pay money for their computer-generated character to wear computer-generated tennis shoes, and they will pay actual real American dollars.
You're 100% right. And, you know, what a lot of times that will happen is the publishers themselves will make them limited edition. So, you know, put yourself in a situation then that supply-demand mechanics kick in and people want to race to buy these skins because they want to be, you know, one of 100 people to wear, you know, the new, you know, Air Jordans that dropped when Marshmello the DJ threw his concert.
I am very familiar with this. I have a 19-year-old son who on Thursdays, he asks me to help him because we're going to try to buy Supreme t-shirts. Now, these are actual t-shirts.
Yep.
You know, that you can, actual people can wear. But this idea that, you know, you race to spend this money because Supreme has deliberately made them, you know, only on a limited run. And you know, I was 19 once as well. So I try to hide my eyes rolling as we try to plunk down $50 for a T-shirt. But that appeal is there.
Definitely. You know, and, you know, the Supreme has been incredible as it relates to small batch manufacturing. And imagine if with that shirt that you buy, not only do you maybe have one of 1,000 shirts, you could actually receive a QR code that could then allow your character in game to wear the same Supreme shirt.
I think you're really going to cost me money with that idea.
Exactly. Right.
Because he well plays Fortnite as well.
Yeah.
So what is Mythical doing in this space with these skins and these virtual items?
Yeah. So basically what Mythical has realized is there's a multi-billion dollar gray market where gamers, you know, will go and purchase skins and they'll realize that supply demand mechanics have kicked in. Other gamers would love to have access to those skins, but there's no real direct way in a publisher supported manner for the gamer to monetize that. So what ends up happening is the gamer will go and deal with like really shady, you know, brokering companies in Asia in order to like sell the password to their account or to use a third party to like drop the skin in game so that someone else can then pick it up. It's a really horrific UI UX. And from Mythical's perspective, by the publishers not actually directly participating and supporting this market, they're actually losing out on billions of dollars of revenue. So what Mythical wants to do is they want to use, you know, blockchain technology just in the sense of having an immutable ledger, so to speak, and really sort of have the publishers start supporting this secondary market so that they can allow gamers to trade skins with other gamers, actually monetize those initial bets and do it in such a way that's publisher supported. And obviously the publishers would get a piece of every sort of skin that is sold.
They could essentially sell it twice. Yeah,
exactly.
Or at least have a piece of the second sale.
100%. Yeah. And what's really interesting about Mythical is not only have they developed the backend infrastructure to sort of bring this publisher supported secondary market to AAA rated games, they themselves are also a AAA rated game developer. So they've got their first game coming out called Blankos. It should release towards the end of this year. I think beta is actually going to be in September. And think of Blankos as like a Fortnite meets Roblox. It's really, really cool sort of vinyl toys that come to life, and you can design your own mini games and your own worlds. And they've got all these incredible artists, creating these limited edition sort of Blankos skins. They want to create this very flourishing ecosystem, and they want to use sort of the back end technology that they've created to power sort of the in-game primary and secondary market for Blankos. So it's really exciting. And if it's done correctly, you really envision a world where you sort of bridge the gap between the physical world and the virtual world. And, I think if you speak to a lot of sort of VR enthusiasts, et cetera, and especially you see here how much time people are spending in their homes, we could be in a situation where 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, your digital representation of yourself is just as important as your physical. And if that kind of happens, you could see, Mythical playing an interesting role in that, at least as it relates to the economy associated with that digital form.
It's not hard to imagine already people's online presence is so critical to them, particularly the younger generation.
Yep, exactly.
You could see that expanding into, actually having accessories and fashion and whatnot, and there being that secondary market.
Yep, exactly.
Now, can you imagine your grandfather Benny pulled rocks out of the ground and sold them? And that's how he made his fortune. Can you imagine explaining that to him?
No, I cannot. And I don't think it would be an easy conversation.
Adam Strzok, founder and managing partner at Strzok Capital in Santa Monica. We mentioned Dhiraj Pandey of Nutanix during the interview. You can find Pandey's conversation with my reporter colleagues, John Swartz of Dow Jones and Farhad Manju of the New York Times, on my television show Press Here, available at pressheretv.com. Just use the little search box at the top to find the keyword Nutanix with an X. Next week on Sand Hill Road, Jody Bonsall, the creator of the company AppDynamics. You know how Pandey decided not to sell his company to Cisco? We just talked about that. And went forward with that IPO? Well, in a weird coincidence, Jody does the opposite. He sells AppDynamics to Cisco on the eve of his company's market debut. That interview next week on Sand Hill Road. Sand Hill Road is produced by Sean Myers under the leadership of Sarah Bueno and Stephanie Adruni.